Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Let's talk.
Johnny Brown.
Goliath's Curse, The History and Future of Cytal Collapse is a new book by Luke Kemp. It's been described as an excellent survey of human history through the collapses of Goliath-like kings, states, and empires. I'm delighted to say that joining us live on the line now is the author of Goliath's Curse, Luke Kemp. Luke, good morning to you, sir.
Morning, Giles. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure's all mine. What's the basic premise of this? Is it the fact that governments have become too unwieldy? We're in too much globalization? What was your basic premise for this?
The key finding of the book, which I researched in the space of 7 years, is that growing wealth inequality and growing concentrations of power is what leads to societies falling apart from the very earliest cities all the way, I believe, to the modern global system.
And so, I mean, to put it mildly, this is a broad sweep of history. I mean, you're not even looking at sort of industrial revolution and then onwards. You're looking at basically since Homo sapiens sort of first stumbled off the African plains. So, I mean, how do you sort of pinpoint that and make it a sort of a compelling and distinctive narrative?
It does begin all the way 300,000 years ago, as you mentioned, from the very beginnings of our species in Africa through to not just the modern world, but the future. The reason I decided to take it so far back was for a few reasons. First of all, when we just look at a few case studies, it's too easy to cherry pick.
Right.
You know, if you look at Jared Darwin's, for instance, his book on collapse, he had 5 case studies. 3 of them are islands, and one of them is in the Yucatan, the classical Maya, which are in a unique topsoil, but tropical climate. It's really hard to tell how analogous they are to the modern world. I think you need to have the most and the best data in order to actually understand the problem fully. And the other big thing here is that whenever people talk about history or collapse, they bring in certain assumptions about human nature. And to me, you can only really understand humans truly if you look all the way back to our evolutionary past. So what I'm trying to do here is actually kind of excavate my own assumptions. Like, what do we know about humans? How did we collapse in the past, all the way from 300,000 years ago to the present? And it leads to some pretty surprising counterintuitive insights that change my mind. For instance, from what we can tell, mass panic is a myth. People don't tend to freak out in a big scramble for resources during disasters. And when you think about it, during the Paleolithic, during the Ice Ages, if we did that, we would not have lasted. Yeah. That is not a good recipe for success. But because we're actually really altruistic and because we're actually really good at adapting and acting pro-socially during disasters, including collapses, that's one of the key reasons we survived the Ice Age. The big picture, I think, is ambitious but necessary.
Here's one of the things, then. Is it the fact that by their very nature, and the spoiler alert, the clue's in the name, that empires are by their very nature unwieldy? And as human beings, we work best in smaller concentrations that can think on their feet, but also think creatively for what's coming up. Because if you go back to what happened, work before in the past, and I'm thinking of all the ancient empires here, when some new technology or some new social economic change or some new environmental change comes on, if you go back to it worked for Queen Victoria, then you're on a hiding to nothing, basically.
I think it is less about being in small groups and more about how we organize our groups. So the big thing that changes when you look at the emergence of what people typically call civilization is not the fact that we're in cities or even that we have agriculture. The biggest change that we see across this idea of civilization is that we start to organize ourselves differently. Previously, so for roughly 300,000 years, were in the plains of Africa and we spread out throughout the world, we were basically in small nomadic egalitarian groups. And although the groups were small, we were very interconnected. So, for instance, we see traded technology, tools, musical instruments all the way from the east to the west coast of Africa. So people are migrating and trading in one big society all across Africa, basically. And we see the similar with what's called the Arab-Nashian culture across Europe.
Yeah.
What changes is once you get the very first states, kingdoms, so Cahokia in North America, Tiwanaku in South America, of course, the first dynasty of Egypt, Uruk in the Near East, is that we start to organize ourselves to look a lot more like a harem of a gorilla or a hierarchy of a chimpanzee. We start to organize into dominance hierarchies with a small group ruling over everyone else through the use of violence. And I think that is the key thing that causes fragility. When you look at, say, for instance, Tiwanaku, which is one of the first cities we have in South America, it essentially has egalitarian origins. So the city originally starts in a pretty egalitarian fashion. We have no signs of inequality or rulers. And then once it actually starts to turn into a more of a dominance hierarchy and become more unequal, that's when it starts to become more fragile. And you see this in a surprisingly large number of cities and early states. And even the very first farmers of Europe, they have these big boom-bust cycles, which seem to correlate roughly with the emergence of rulers and inequality. I think the key thing here is that we are not built for being in dominance hierarchies, and we're not built for being in highly unequal societies.
I mean, one interesting things you say there, and I want a couple of points I can come back on with this one is the fact that when you talk about South America, it's interesting that you've highlighted it in your book that the collapse of these societies is written up as end of the world stuff, when in fact it's actually more it is more beneficial to them. Explain a little bit about what you mean by that, please, Luke.
Yeah, of course. So one of the most surprising results I had when looking into this book was collapse was often a good thing for most of the populace. Mm. Many of us think about the fall of Rome as being this horrible apocalyptic event. And yet the skeletons across Europe tell a very different story. When you look at skeletons after the fall of the West Roman Empire, people seem to get taller and healthier. They have less what are called dental caries, basically holes in their teeth, mm-hmm. and bone lesions. And not only does that happen in Rome, it also happens after the fall of the Late Bronze Age as well, across the Near East and Mediterranean. So that's the Assyrian Empire, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, etc. When they all fall apart, it also seems like people end up better. They have more grave goods, and additionally, they seem to be taller as well. Why, you may ask? A big thing here is that states in the past weren't like Spain or Denmark. They weren't good democracies that provided lots of welfare for the citizens. They were pretty predatory regimes. And it wasn't just the people after Rome got taller. It's also people outside of the Roman Empire were taller. That trope of the big muscle-bound Germanic barbarian, it has some truth to it, because to the Romans, the Germans would have looked actually much bigger. And that's for several reasons. One is that they probably relied less upon grain. Grain was what was used as a tax crop within Rome and most empires as well, so you were forced to basically grow more grain. But also, you were paying a lot of your grain and your tax, obviously, to the Roman Empire. When suddenly you don't have to pay the tax anymore, you end up better off for it. And it's worthwhile bearing in mind, this is something that extends into the modern world. So one of the most mind-blowing examples is, most of you are probably familiar with the collapse of Somalia. So Somalia falls apart in 1991, the Barre regime. And afterwards, so a decade after the fall of the Barre regime in 1991, infant mortality drops by 24%. Maternal mortality drops by 30%. And extreme poverty drops by 20%. And that's not because like all of the region was getting better. Somalia actually does substantially better than all of the neighbors, which didn't fail around it. So collapse surprisingly can be a good thing, but the caveat is I don't think it'd be a good thing going into the future.
Yeah, because obviously there's an awful lot of inbuilt corruption in the systems as well. So as money is being taken out, the medicals are being diverted. The idea though of a collapse, i.e. one day you open the curtains, you know, there I am in the Western Roman Empire, open the curtains one day and there's a mob of whatever coming towards me, you know, 6 foot tall guys with huge moustaches. And then, you know, Rome gets sacked. Well, you know, hey, Saxons and what, but the Franks and all that. But So collapses don't tend to be that quick, do they? They tend to be long, drawn-out things. Because Rome gets sacked, you know, in the, you know, the 4th century or 5th century, whatever. You know, on basically, you know, it's Thursday, we're being sacked again by the Alans this week. So you see what I'm saying? It's never as, like, a Hollywood movie. You don't open, you don't, like Atlantis, you don't say, look, there's a huge tidal wave coming towards you. So there are gradual increments of moving away from these hierarchical societies then, Luke?
Yes, in the case of Rome, for instance, I don't talk about the fall of Rome. I think there are multiple falls of Rome. In a moral sense, I think Rome falls when it actually turns into an empire, right? I mean, in a way, it was always an empire. It was always conquering its neighbors. But when you have Julius Caesar basically becoming a permanent dictator, and then, of course, Augustus taking over, you basically get a movement away from it being a pretty exceptional large-scale republic. You know, it always still had a lot of corruption. It was still very power-concentrated, but at least it had some trimmings of democracy, to just being of a large military dictatorship. So that would be the first kind of fall of Rome. But then it also basically falls apart during the first century crisis. You have Italy just racked by wars and coups. There's a huge succession of different rulers. They're struggling to keep things together. And then, of course, as you mentioned, there are at least two different sackings during the first century, followed by a large pandemic and, of course, the actual kind of the fall of Rome or the Western Roman Empire, as we think about it. But the Eastern Roman Empire, that continued on until roughly 1453.
Yeah, exactly. When Suleiman the Great and all that, and then don't get me down the rat rabbit hole, Luke, because we'll be here till we'll be here the next Tuesday, and the listeners are going, "Oh, blimey, he's going to mention the Carthaginians in a minute." So, therefore, let's move.
Who actually had a much quicker collapse, interestingly.
I was about to say, because that is an example of a huge power that is absolutely raised to the ground, literally, in a way that you don't see in most of the Western Mediterranean. And trust me, I'm based in southern Spain, so. You know, throw a sticky and hit something Punic. Right then. What does that mean, though? How does that transfer then to today? Because today we have super states. We are talking about big power unit. I mean, we're talking about, global influence. What sort of warning signs should we be looking out for, Luke? And what is setting your alarm bells flashing then from the book Goliath's Curse?
So let's take a step back and first of all define what the Goliath's Curse is and then what's different today in comparison to the past. So Goliath's Curse is this idea that big systems of dominance hierarchies of power tend to contain the seeds of their own demise. What people would normally call civilization, I call Goliath. And the key thing here is that we know that wealth inequality tends to increase over time. And that tends to spill over into other forms of power. We see that happening today, right? In the 1980s, wealth concentrations, the top 1% owned roughly 25% of global wealth. Today, it's closer to 40%. And when you look at the democratic backsliding we've had in places like the UK and places like the US, who's behind it? It's the grinning face of big tech oligarchs and billionaires, people like Elon Musk and like Donald Trump. But this is a very long story. This has essentially always happened. You've always had increasing wealth inequality resulting in more concentration of power. And that has some pretty nefarious effects on a society. So in the case of Rome, for instance, we do have some evidence that seems to increase tax evasion and corruption. Additionally, you start to get more elite infighting. So basically, you start to have a more top-heavy society with more elites battling out for positions. This is based on some of the work of Peter Turchin. And so they start to do coups. They start to find new ways to battle it out for power. But they also tend to push the rest of the populace to both work harder and to extract more from their environment as well. So you have all these big knock-on effects. You have worse decision-making, you have more extraction from the environment, you have elite infighting, you have corruption. Over time, that hollows a society out. And look at today. I mean, we can see a similar thing happen, right? But on top of that, today is kind of worse because it's not just simply that we're making societies more fragile. We're also producing much worse threats, whether it's AI, extreme climate change, or nuclear weapons.
One of the things that, as well, because people keep going, oh, well, the Romans have got an absolute, that hasn't got any bearing on modern life. But if you think about it, you need to, one of the reasons that the Western Roman Empire survived so long is that you need to be in a permanent state of war, the whole raison d'etre behind Rome. Is that's why they've always got, legions wandering around their empire, getting rid of, but that leads to their downfall, because when you go onto that period of imperial as opposed to republican Rome, then you have, the emperor's snuffed it. Everybody get back to Rome with your army and try and, you know, have a civil war. Are we therefore seeing, Luke, could be therefore seeing, I'm not saying that Elon Musk is about to sort of unleash his own mercenaries. Hopefully not anyway. But do you see what I'm saying? So you need an aim. You need somebody to keep the population arisen. So we're doing this because we are perpetually at war with Germania or Britannia or wherever. Scipius Africanus, etc. So are we therefore, is the thing to keep the population concentrated on something else, a policy that makes you look, I mean, we call it the dead cat theory, you know, you throw the dead cat on the table, everybody looks that way. And so therefore, is that the sort of thing that we're seeing at the moment with government saying, this is what we've got to concentrate on, where, you know, so they can continue to take their percentage or have their influence, Luke?
In short, yes. One of the ideas I talk about in the book is this idea of the authoritarian impulse. We have really good evidence from both social psychology and from neuroscience that when people feel threatened, it changes their brains. In particular, people tend to become more authoritarian. They become more embracing of authoritarian structures and become more obedient. And those who are already far-right authoritarians tend to become more politically mobilized and more violent as well. And I think this is something which helps explain why we had that original shift from being nomadic egalitarian hunter-gatherers into suddenly forming into these kind of more violent big dominance hierarchies. But it is, of course, something we see today as well. Most countries that are having some form of democratic backsliding, they have some kind of enemy that the dictator is using, right? And almost in every case, it's usually either the neighbors or migrants. And of course, it's usually not actually migrants or neighbors who are causing the problem. It's usually power holders inside the rich. And unfortunately, the left has not done a good job, I think, of actually articulating what the problem is here. But on top of that, I think it's worthwhile bearing in mind that Rome did overstretch, right? It did have definitely imperial overstretch. Rome was basically a machine for turning grain into swords, and it was a pyramid scheme. You basically conquer your neighbors, you enlist those neighbors to help you conquer more neighbors, etc. And over time, that leads to diminishing costs or diminishing returns. You basically have to conquer further afield for more money. It drains the budget. It's hard not to see how the US is doing the same thing right now. But importantly, when you have these societies which are built upon perpetual conflict, it also tends to lead to arms races. And one of the big things I talk about in the book is not what are the individual threats we face today, like climate change, nuclear weapons, et cetera, but what's actually driving us to produce these things?
That's just really interesting though, because, and I just love the comment that I never had that before, but the Roman Empire was a pyramid scheme. It makes perfect sense. But also the other thing is you talk about this backsliding, you know, look at, and you just look at the way that people are, a lot of the polls are coming through, and I know we shouldn't trust polls, but an awful lot of people are getting disenfranchised with what they see as democracy. And therefore they're saying what we need is a strong leader. Okay. And going through history, you've always wanted a strong leader, be it a king, be it an emperor or whatever. But that tends to lead to maybe a decade or even less in some cases of everything's going fine. And then it drops off a cliff and you end up looking like the front cover of your book, basically, because there's this end of the, you know, you only got to look at Berlin for, you know, Berlin 45, et cetera, or, you know, Ceausescu 1989. And you see that everything finishes and then they have to start again all over. Is that a cycle that we should be aware of, Luke?
In general, yes. There is definitely a movement towards wealth inequality increase over time. That results in more concentrations of power. That slowly hollows out a society until it's eventually knocked out. That shell is broken asunder by things like climate change, war, and pandemics. The key thing to bear in mind here is that the modern world in many ways faces a kind of big, even bigger problem here. It's not just simply we're facing that cycle. I think the US in particular, for instance, is on its way towards having a lot of instability. Yet it's also that the actual societies we have, the global system we have, what I call the global life, is producing threats that could do far more damage. We talk about this all the time, right? We have 10,000 nuclear weapons still in the world. Any given day, even today, there could be one mistake which results in a thermonuclear war. Mm-hmm. And potentially the loss of, at least according to the latest figures, sort of 5 billion lives, potentially even more. We, of course, are facing climate change that is roughly, what, could be 5 to 6 degrees by the end of the century, depending upon estimates. And that's last time we had 5 or 6 degrees in the Earth system, that set off a mass extinction event. These things are also, I believe, coming from concentrations of wealth and power. So if you look at greenhouse gas emissions, the top 10% account for roughly, I think it's 66% of emissions, something like that. And if you look at nuclear weapons, 85% of the stockpiles are by two countries, and the two bigger countries in the world, of course, Russia and the US. And if you look at emissions globally, roughly 80% of emissions come from 20 countries, and 25% of those emissions come from one country, historically, the US. Mm-hmm. In short, things like nuclear weapons, AI, climate change, they're coming from big concentrations of power, what I call the agents of doom. Mm-hmm. And it's not just they're producing them by accident, they're usually producing them for profit and power, and they're usually trying to cover it up as well. You know, fossil fuel companies like BP, they knew about climate change, they had their own modeling of it back in the 1980s. They intentionally buried that evidence and ran disinformation campaigns. And that's pretty emblematic of how AI companies are acting today, and also how the military-industrial complex has operated both in the past and today. So it's not, unfortunately, just that we are facing societies that are becoming potentially more fragile. It's also that producing these new threats. And just as a quick aside, you mentioned this kind of movement away from democracy. And I think the key problem here is that we have evidence that democracies are actually more resilient. So this is based on some work by Peter Peregrine at Yale University, where he looked at things like the Little Ice Age, basically periods where you had cooling across large parts of the world. And he tried to compare how much do societies cool versus how much they change. Did they have big losses of population? Did they lose a leader, et cetera? Did they collapse? And the astounding finding was that the biggest factor in ensuring societies had a smoother time, that they were more resilient against climatic change, was how inclusive they were, how much people were involved with everyday governance. And we see the same in modern-day studies of modern risk, that if you're looking at modern disasters, whether it's a hurricane or an earthquake, societies that have stronger states but also more democratic tend to be the best ones at both buffering the shocks and recovering from the disaster. So all the evidence points towards democracies are more resilient. Yet, unfortunately, we do have this impulse to turn away from democracy when we feel threatened. And that is a very bad, counterproductive idea.
What are you hoping that people are going to take from your book, The Last Curse? What are you hoping that people will consider?
A few things. First of all, I hope we start to take global risk more seriously. It's a travesty we haven't had elections decided by things like nuclear weapons or climate change, particularly in places like the US. Secondly, I hope it triggers a change and a turn back towards democracy. As mentioned, democracy seems to be one of the more resilient forms of society. I think it's also the more moral form. But on top of that, even if we're thinking about these big risks like nuclear weapons, I think that democracy, particularly an older form of democracy, is one of the best ways of ensuring a safer future. So in Athens, they had this idea of sortition, where basically you randomly select citizens to represent the polity. And we often call this now deliberative democracy. You randomly select people, you bring them together in an assembly or jury, you have them briefed by experts to reach a conclusion. Now, I want to give a quick example of what I call a Trinity jury. So you're probably familiar with the Trinity test back in 1945. Yeah, this was the explosion of the first nuclear weapon at the Manhattan Project.
Yeah.
Before they were about to fire that weapon, the physicist Edward Teller made a calculation that they couldn't rule out the possibility that detonating the bomb would ignite the entire atmosphere, would cause a chain reaction that would spread across the entirety of Earth, extinguishing all life, not just humans, every life form. They, of course, still decided to go ahead and detonate the bomb. If you had instead a democratic decision, so you took a random selection of citizens from the US or even from the globe, and you said to them, look, there's a chance this could destroy literally everyone. And by the way, the Nazis are no longer building their own bomb. This is not about beating the Third Reich to the bomb. This is about supremacy. What decision do you think the citizens make?
It's pretty much a no-brainer.
Pretty clear cut. Yeah, pretty clear cut. And I think exactly the same today. Like if you had citizens sitting over the top of BP when they decided to bury the evidence on climate change, they would have said, no, that's a bad idea. So I think that despite our impulses to turn away from democracy, the only way we are going to navigate the coming centuries and not self-terminate is by turning towards democracy. And I hope that's one of the biggest lessons people take from the book.
The book is called Goliath's Curse, the History and Future of Societal Collapse. It's by Luke Kemp. Listeners, you can go into our own virtual bookstore, click on the front cover picture that is on the website now, and a well-known delivery service will have it winging its way to you. Luke, if people want to find you online and say nice things to you, where should they find you?
Ooh, I have very little online presence, unfortunately. I am on Mastodon and Blue Sky under Luke Kemp, I believe, at Luke Kemp. I'll probably be starting a Substack sometime in the future, but unfortunately I have very little social media. There's no Graham to call me on.
Right, fair enough. Well, go forth then, listeners, and order the book. The book is called Goliath's Curse. It's by Luke Kemp. Luke, it's been an absolute eye-opener to speak to you this morning.
Giles, my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.